Welcome to the Psychedelic Experience, right here on 89.5 WJMU The Quad. For the next 2 hours, we're dropping the needle on all of the best mind-altering experiences that radio has to offer. So sit back and relax with me, the Psych Professor, and my co-host, DJ Mellow Yellow, right here on 89.5. Stay tuned. There's a fog upon LA, and my friends have lost their way. We'll be over soon, they say. Now they've lost themselves instead. So if it hasn't become abundantly obvious yet, we're going to be talking a little bit this evening about an album that neither of those tracks are from, so probably it isn't abundantly obvious. But we opened there with a little bit of Magical Mystery Tour, and then that was the Big Jim Sullivan there in his alter ego, Lord Sitar, doing a little bit of George Harrison's Blue Jay Way from the LP and the film Magical Mystery Tour. But last week we promised you we'd be looking into the White Album. Mellow Yellow couldn't come up with his part. Just couldn't do it. Had the flu this week. I'm stepping in solo. I've already realized how hard it is to host solo. It's been so long since I've done it. But we're going to be talking about the White Album and the Manson phenomenon. And I realize, as we said last week, we do not in any way on the Psychedelic Experience want to lionize or martyr Manson in any way, shape, or form. As I said last week, I echoed the sentiments, good riddance, from Rosemary herself, saying that it was a good thing, you know, happy that he's gone. And yet, it just can't be lost on people that it's just such a significant element of the subculture that we like to talk about so much here on the Psychedelic Experience. And while Mellow Yellow and I are big true crime fans, I think he and I would say that the Manson murders are some of the most disgusting and disturbing. And I think I want to say I've read more about them than he has. I've read all of Vincent Bugliosi's Helter Skelter. I'm reading Ed Sanders' The Family, the stories of Charles Manson's Dune Buggy Attack Battalion right now. We're also going to hear a little bit from Joan Didion's The White Album tonight, the book that, took the name from the Beatles' famous self-titled but colloquially referred to White Album. But here's just a little bit I want to read from Ed Sanders in The Family, the book that he published in the early 1970s. On December 8, 1968, Capitol Records released the Beach Boys' single Bluebirds Over the Mountain, Never Learn Not to Love, Cease to Exist, which, of course, we played last week. Charles Manson was on the charts. A more important event occurred, however, on December 7th. Capitol Records released the white-jacketed Beatles double album containing among the 30 songs such gems of snuff as Sexy Sadie, Rocky Raccoon, Blackbird, Revolution No. 9, and Helter Skelter, all found by Manson to foretell his conquest of the world. And so one of the really interesting things about Ed Sanders' The Family and the research that he did, at least for the first half of the book, which is what I've gotten through at this point, he's really a lot more about chronicling and trying to figure out what Manson was doing in the years prior to the Tate and LaBianca murders or the Cielo Drive murders or the Polanski murders, as they are sometimes known. And, of course, the tie-ins there to Mia Farrow are obvious, and she is, as I said earlier, Rosemary, her good riddance that she said to Manson. Well, it becomes sort of interesting to see all the connections that all these people had. I know I mentioned last week a passage from Didion's book where she says this strange connection about how she remembers buying her wedding dress, which was a cocktail dress, the morning of Kennedy's assassination. And that was sort of this changeover moment that symbolized or became the beginning of a new time, which she, you know, says eventually became the 60s in our retrospect. And that dress had been ruined when red wine was spilled on it at a dinner party by Mr. Roman Polanski. And then she says that she found it interesting and ironic and terrible and coincidental that Linda Kasabian, whose testimony eventually put Manson away for the murder of Polanski's wife, she purchased the dress that she testified in. So these weird connections that just make Southern California, especially the Southern California arts community at the time, feel like there were a lot more interconnections than maybe
we would anticipate, but I always feel that's kind of the nature of art. When you hear that Hemingway and Dali and Fitzgerald were all hanging out and drinking together in bars in Paris, and you think, I guess it kind of makes sense that people who feel inspired and feel artistic passion are going to gravitate towards one another, and they're going to bounce ideas off of one another. And of course, there's a great play on that in Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris, where this character goes back to Paris of that era and runs into all these people. But it is interesting. Didion talks about what it was like to be in the recording studio, just happened to be in the recording studio when the Doors were recording their albums and things like that. And so it's just this weird connection that sort of comes all together that makes the Manson, I don't want to even call it mythos. And again, not everything, the research on Manson, what he was doing in the years leading up to the Cielo Drive murders and the murders that followed, the LaBianca family, Rosemary and Lino LaBianca, I believe were their names, the couple that was killed. It's just such odd stuff. It's these odd connections that make it seem like this was, that LA was a smaller town. And it was then, of course. But it's just, it's so strange. So anyway, we're going to take a look at how the White Album, the Beatles release, plays into all of Manson's sort of delusions and things like that. But again, I want to underline here, we do not want to submit Manson for martyrdom or lionize him. I mean, I think almost half century in prison after the murders, and he'd spent half of his life in institutions up until then, certainly seems like it was justified. But we're going to get to some more music here, and we're going to kind of shift. One of the reasons I started by playing Magical Mystery Tour, though, is Ed Sanders' research covers some elements of Manson's life in 1968 leading up to the release of the White Album and his written single that the Beach Boys recorded. And in those years in 68, 67, leading up to it, he purchased a school bus at one point and painted it all black. And in a true dark reflection of the wavy gravy further, you know, bus experiments and the acid tests and things like that, in the true dark reflection, this black painted bus. And Manson apparently, or the people who Sanders interviewed, said, well, it was just the cheapest color. This school bus, he was driving it back up and down the coast of California from the Bay Area through the deserts along the 101 and things like that, basically collecting his flock, what would come to, of course, be known as the Manson family, and eventually driving it almost unfathomably up into some really difficult places to access in Death Valley. And the idea that he drove a school bus up through the canyons north of LA and got the bus to the ranches that the Manson family lived back and forth between is just fascinating. But he often, after the release of the Beatles' Magical Mystery Tour, their television special movie and album in the United States in late 67, referred to the bus as the Magical Mystery Tour, the never-ending up-and-down collection of people that he sort of envisioned as being the future until the coming of Helter Skelter. Of course, what Bugliosi theorized, and what most people have culturally confirmed, is that Helter Skelter was Manson's term for the race war that he believed was coming upon the human race and that he believed would eventually lead to his domination of the world. And so we'll get into some of the details there, and they are weird, and so maybe, you know, a little bit of a spoiler alert here. This may be not the episode to listen to with kids. I won't in any way get too graphic or anything like that, but it's just hard to in any way think about this positively, but it is worth our coverage, I think. Not to say that our coverage is going to be just stellar, but worth listening in that it's just so unfortunately connected to this musical movement and this arts movement that Mellow Yellow and I delve into every week here on the Psychedelic Experience on 89.5 WJMU. Now, one of the things that if you look up, just even doing cursory preliminary research of Manson's connection to the White Album, one of the things that you're going to find is that a lot of the songs that had anything close to religious symbolism in them, and some that don't even have any construable religious symbolism, Manson very much thought that the Beatles were calling out to him. He believed himself in one way, shape, or form to be Jesus Christ, or that Helter Skelter would prompt the coming of Jesus Christ, and there is some debate about that. And again, they're both delusions, obviously, at this point. We can say that, I think, with absolute assurance. But in any case, a lot of the tracks Manson interpreted as the Beatles calling to him, as Jesus asking him, Manson Jesus, to respond to them. And one of the major ones here is Honey Pie. And you will see in the lyrics, or hear in the lyrics, I suppose, about come across the Atlantic and things like that, that he felt the Beatles were calling to him. So we're going to get back to the music here on the Psychedelic Experience. This is the Beatles from the White Album. This is Honey Pie.
Working girl north of England way.
Now she's in the big time
in the USA, and if she could only hear me, this is what I'd say. Honey pie, you are making me crazy. I'm in love but I'm lazy, so won't you please come home. Oh honey pie, my position is tragic. Come and show me the magic of your Hollywood song. You became a legend of the silver screen, and now the thought of meeting you makes me weak in the knee. Oh, honey pie, you are driving me frantic. Sail across the Atlantic to be where you belong. Honey pie, come back to me. Yeah. I like that. Ooh, I like this kind of hot kind of music. Hot kind of music. Play it to me. Play it to me, Hollywood blue. Will the wind that blew her boat across the sea kindly send her sailing back to me? Ch-ch-ch-ch. Now, honey pie, you are making me crazy. I'm in love, but I'm lazy. So won't you please come home? Come, come back to me, honey pie.
She came along to turn on everyone. Somewhere in the black mining hills of Dakota, there lived a young boy named Rocky Raccoon. One day his woman ran off with another guy, hit young Rocky in the eye. Rocky didn't like that, he said, I'm gonna get that boy. So one day he walked into town, booked himself a room in the local saloon. Rocky Raccoon checked into his room, only to find Gideon's Bible. Rocky had come equipped with a gun to shoot out the legs of his rival. His rival, it seems, had broken his dream by stealing the girl of his fancy. Her name was McGill, and she called herself Lil, but everyone knew her as Nancy. Now she and her man, who called himself Dan, were in the next room at the hoedown. A Rocky burst in, and grinning a grin, he said, Danny boy, this is a showdown. But Daniel was hot, he drew fast and shot, and Rocky collapsed in the corner. Proceeded to lie on the table. He said, Rocky, you met your match. And Rocky said, Doc, it's only a scratch. And I'll be better, Doc, as soon as I am able. And now Rocky Raccoon, he fell back in his room, only to find Gideon's Bible. Gideon checked out, and he left it no doubt to help with good.
Rocky Raccoon there, of course, from disc one of the Helter Skelter inspiring White Album. My cadence is just off tonight. I need some Mellow Yellow in my life. Good vibes. Send good vibes Mellow Yellow's way, folks, because seriously, he's had the flu a bunch already this year. Feel bad for him. Dude needs to get a shot. Okay, so we're going to take a look. We heard Honey Pie there, followed by Sexy Sadie, and then, of course, Rocky Raccoon. And I told you, Honey Pie in many ways was felt by Manson with lyrics like, "Oh, Honey Pie, my position is tragic. Come and show me the magic of your Hollywood song." And, of course, Manson thought that meant that the Beatles were calling for him to record his opus album, which would again kick off Helter Skelter, the race war and in many ways the holy war that would lead to the extinction of the white race. But Manson would emerge from hiding at the end of the war, and he would take back over as the leader of those human beings who had survived the war. Just crazy, crazy, crazy stuff that he was going to... I don't even want to get into the race elements. It's all so crazy. Other than to mention again that, of course, there was a connection made between Manson and the song Rocky Raccoon about the revival of this false character, this fictional character here. And Manson, of course, thought that that had some racial overtones or undertones as well. And this was in... So a Rolling Stone issue was being written about Manson during the trial, and I think it was David Dalton and David Felton who were the Rolling Stone writers who visited Manson in L.A. County Jail during the trial, and that's when he explained to him, or explained to them, I'm sorry, the significance of the Rocky Raccoon title and how the race war was always going to play out. It is, of course, also the only song on the album that directly mentions the Bible, so pretty interesting there too. And of course, Sexy Sadie that we heard in the middle there. Now, Susan Adkins, who had been a topless dancer from the Bay Area, had been picked up by Manson sometime in 1967 or 1968. And according to the testimony and the testimony, I guess, is the best way to say it, and the writings of individuals who had been members of the Manson family, some in the inner circle, some on the periphery, but said that Susan Adkins, who Manson dubbed Sadie Mae Glutz, it's questionable as to whether or not he called her Sadie prior to the release of the album, although some members of the family do claim that he did. Some said he called her Sadie. Some said that he had called her Sexy Sadie many times, again, because the writings of these individuals said and suggested that Susan Adkins was particularly an avid lover, I suppose is the most PG way to put that in radio terms there. And I will attempt to be as clean as possible here as I can. But according to Paul Watkins, she, quote, thrived on sex. And Tex Watson said this as well, effectively, and that the Beatles having a song called Sexy Sadie, which if Manson wasn't calling her that prior to the release of the album in December of 68, he certainly was afterwards, made people think that, well, that it made us all sure that the Beatles had to be singing directly to us. So... again, it's a lot of it is speculation. These are not in many ways trustworthy narrators, and yet we have to in some way piece together, I think, things from their testimonies and again from their testimony at trial and the things that they wrote and the things that they testified to in chambers and stuff like that. I'm trying to think, what is this? You're subpoenaed and you've got Mellow Yellow. If he was here, he would help me with this. Deposition. That is the word I have been looking for quite some time here. Okay. Also want to note, we played that Blue Jay Way song right after we started with Magical Mystery Tour tonight. And interestingly enough, George Harrison never gave Vincent Bugliosi permission to directly reference any of his songs in the book Helter Skelter. What that means, I don't know, but it is pretty interesting. Also, connection there, some people thought that Lord Sitar, who largely now believed to be guitarist and session musician Big Jim Sullivan, that it was in fact George Harrison. So, again, these loose but strange connections here. All right, we are going to get back to the music here, and I'll do some readings from that Joan Didion book. Really cool author. You've got to check out. Netflix has a new documentary about her. I believe it's called Joan Didion, The Center Will Not Hold. Fantastic. And culminates with her getting her Presidential Medal of Freedom from Barack Obama. And it's just amazing to see this footage. And Michelle Obama is one of the first people to rise and give a standing ovation. This person whose prose in many ways came to symbolize the fallout of the 1960s. So, as I said, we're going to read that on the other side of some music here. But now, we're going to go to a little bit more Manson-inspiring songs here. And again, don't want to lionize. Do not in any way want to put Manson up for sainthood or martyrdom. We're simply attempting to chronicle his obsession here with the White Album. So here is Happiness is a Warm Gun on the Psychedelic Experience on 89.5 WJMU The Quad.
She's not a girl who misses much. Oh yeah. She's well acquainted with the touch of the velvet hand, like a lizard on a window pane. The man in the crowd with the multicolored mirrors on his hobnail boots, lying with his eyes while his hands are busy working overtime. A soap impression of his wife, which he ate and donated to the National Trust.
Mother Superior jumped the gun. 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 Always have clean shirts to play around in.
Biggie Wives, clutching for tonight to eat the bacon.
And of course, that is Piggies there. Some really strange connections. Of course, the word pig written in blood at the site of the Tate murders. Pretty gruesome stuff there. You're listening to our White Album / Charlie Manson special. We are tonight celebrating the 49th anniversary of the White Album, while completely condemning and hopefully informing, but not in any way inspiring people to do anything other than look into and do some research on the Manson family and check out some of that stuff. And I think anybody who is sort of removed from that but heard about Manson's death just a few weeks ago and some of the animus that was displayed by plenty of people who weren't celebrating his death but rather saying that there wouldn't be much mourning for him. And certainly, if you look into anything about the Manson murders, you understand why that is the case. And particularly some of the lyrics in Piggies, the song we just heard there, well, really gruesome stuff. The second set of killings, and the ones that are often much less discussed, are the LaBianca murders, which happened few days, I believe, just maybe even one or two after the Manson family had attacked the Tate residence. Now, the interesting thing is that I believe Manson was actually at the LaBianca scene. He was not at all at the Tate scene at Cielo Drive, or at least he wasn't there during the murders, although significant evidence connected by Ed Sanders and collected by Ed Sanders, I suppose, connects Manson to having been to that house at least a few times prior to the murders. Whether or not he specifically targeted that house, still up for debate, although I think there is some significant evidence that suggests that, having to do with the house's owner, Terry Melcher, and things like that, that I won't go into too much to say, other than it's, again, these strange LA connections that just seem to be, none of them in their own right is all that crazy or all that concrete, but many times it's the building up and the subsequent evidence and the compiling of it, and it just feels as though it gets compounded, and it really feels like that in the case of the Manson murders. But at the LaBianca murders, where I believe, again, Manson believed he was present there, although he was not directly responsible for any of the deaths as far as being the person who carried out the murders, it is believed that he might have had something to do with, in many ways, mimicking the lyrics of Piggies there, where it says, "Dinner with their piggy wives, clutching forks and knives to eat their bacon." Well, Lino LaBianca, and again, warning, graphic content, was found with a knife in his throat and a fork plunged into his stomach, and of course the words "Helter Skelter" written on the fridge of a LaBianca home, misspelled but written in. Okay, so we're going to play one more track here. This is going to be a mini-sode, by the way. We would have done a full episode, but with Mellow Yellow being under the weather, it just doesn't feel right. I love the guy. I miss him already. Hope we can get together later this week. We were hoping to talk about quite a bit this week after last week's fun conversation about the upcoming movies that are supposed to be some of the best of 2017. But anyway, if you can shoot some good vibes Mellow Yellow's way, it's much appreciated here on the Psychedelic Experience. And we thank you very much as I'm flying solo here this evening on 89.5 WJMU. So, another aspect of the Manson phenomena, or the Manson story, was his belief that the family were going to hide in a hole in the desert that led down to a subterranean city while the race war that was Helter Skelter played out. Well, some of the connections that have been made in retrospect said that might be maybe some connection to this upcoming song. So here's a little bit of Everybody's Got Something to Hide Except for Me and My Monkey on the Psychedelic Experience 89.5.
Solution.
the Beatles with Revolution 1 there. We're now going to go listen to a little bit of number 9. And over that, I'm going to be reading a little bit here from Joan Didion's fantastic The White Album essay here. And again, I can't stress enough how great that documentary is that's from Netflix, The Center Will Not Hold, Joan Didion. But here's a little bit about what she has to say about L.A. in the late 1960s. We put Lay Lady Lay on the record player and Suzanne. We went down to Melrose Avenue to see the Flying Burritos. There was a jasmine vine grown over the veranda of the big house on Franklin Avenue, and in the evenings the smell of jasmine came in through all the open doors and windows. I made bouillabaisse for people who did not eat meat. I imagined that my own life was simple and sweet, and sometimes it was, but there were odd things going on around town. There were rumors, there were stories. Everything was unmentionable, but nothing was unimaginable. This mystical flirtation with the idea of sin, this sense that it was possible to go, quote, too far, and that many people were doing it, was very much with us in Los Angeles in 1968 and 69. A demented and seductive vortical tension was building in the community. The jitters were setting in. I recall a time when the dogs barked every night and the moon was always full. On August 9th, 1969, I was sitting in the shallow end of my sister-in-law's swimming pool in Beverly Hills when she received a telephone call from a friend who had just heard about the murders at Sharon Tate Polanski's house on Cielo Drive. The phone rang many times during the next hour. These early reports were garbled and contradictory. One caller would say hoods, the next would say chains. There were 20 dead, no, 12, 10, 18. Black masses were imagined and bad trips blamed. I remember all of the day's misinformation very clearly, and I also remember this, and I wish that I did not. I remember that no one was surprised. Many people I know in Los Angeles believe that the 60s ended abruptly on August 9, 1969, ended at the exact moment when words of the murders on Cielo Drive traveled like brush fire through the community, and in a sense, this is true. The tension broke that day. The paranoia was fulfilled. In another sense, the 60s did not truly end for me until January of 1971, when I left the house on Franklin Avenue and moved to a house on the sea. This particular house on the sea had itself been very much a part of the 60s, and for some months after we took possession, I would come across souvenirs of that period in its history, a piece of Scientology literature beneath a drawer lining, a copy of Stranger in a Strange Land stuffed deep on a closet shelf. But after a while we did some construction, and between the power saws and the sea wind, the place got exorcised. I have known since then very little about the movements of the people who seemed to me emblematic of those years. I know, of course, that Eldridge Cleaver went to Algeria and came home an entrepreneur. I know that Jim Morrison died in Paris. I know that Linda Kasabian fled in search of the pastoral to New Hampshire, where I once visited her. She also visited me in New York, and we took our children on the Staten Island Ferry to see the Statue of Liberty. I also know that in 1975, Paul Ferguson, while serving a life sentence for the murder of Roman Navarro, won first prize in a pen fiction contest and announced plans to, quote, continue my writing. Writing had helped him, he said, to, quote, reflect on experience and see what it means. Quite often I reflect on the big house in Hollywood, on midnight confessions and on Roman Navarro, and on the fact that Roman Polanski and I are godparents to the same child, but writing has not yet helped me to see what it all means. The words of Joan Didion, read as a part of a critical review of her The White Album. Now let's listen to the rest of the sound collage.
Thank you. Watusi, the twist, Eldorado. Take this, brother. May it serve you well.
Maybe it's not
there. What?
What? Oh. Maybe even then.
And that, of course, was Revolution 9 from the White Album. We celebrate that LP's release 49 years ago today here in the United States. And, of course, question why all of the senseless violence that came with it. So we want to thank you for listening this evening to a somewhat protracted episode, a mini-sode, if you will, of the Psychedelic Experience. Again, please send good vibes the way of Mellow Yellow as he attempts to recover from a nasty bout of the flu here for the second time in, 4 weeks. So, feeling terrible for him. But we want to remind you, we will be back next week. Not sure yet if that is going to be our Christmas special or if it'll be the following week. We both have to take a look at our schedules as far as travel goes for the holidays. But we, of course, want to wish you the happiest of holidays, and the happiness of the White Album's 49th anniversary today. Until we see you next time, avoid scratches and stay in the groove.
When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide. When I stop and I turn and I go for a ride. You want me to love you? I'm coming down fast, but I'm miles above you. Tell me, tell me, tell me. Come on, tell me the answer. Well, you may be a lover, but you ain't.
park and I go back to the top of the slide. And I stop and I turn and I go for a ride. And I get to the bottom and I see you again. Yeah, yeah. But do you, don't you want me to make it? We'll be right back.